Hey, everyone out there, and thanks again for joining us here at ASAP Nowcast, the podcast for ASAP Now. As you know, we like to be a feature of the magazine, but sometimes an extension of it for pieces that we didn't run in print. And while I spend a lot of time here talking about the practice of emergency medicine and workforce, I always try to take it back to clinical updates and reviews because, after all, that is what we do. We do emergency medicine. This month, we have a great one. It's a condition you have definitely seen, probably multiple times in every shift, and that is hyperglycemia. Specifically, non-emergency hyperglycemia. Because you know the patient, chief complaint of XYZ, but blood sugar of 350 and maybe a diagnosis of diabetes, maybe not a diagnosis of diabetes. I wanted to feature this discussion on the management of hyperglycemia because sometimes emergency medicine isn't sexy. Sometimes it's not an emergency at all. But we need to remember that in those instances, often we're all the patient has in terms of any healthcare access. So we should be appropriately prepared to treat them, even though it's not something that's staunchly in our wheelhouse. So check it out. Hey everyone at ASAP Now, thanks again for joining us for this month's podcast about hyperglycemia. Now, this is a great one to take it back to the basics and great timing because we have a couple doctors here with us today. Dr. Evan Springer, who is a graduating fourth year EM resident at Ohio Health Doctors Hospital, and also Dr. Howard Levitin, the research director and core faculty at Ohio Health Doctors Hospital. So thanks again, you guys, for coming and joining us.
Well, thank you.
Now, I loved covering this topic because you guys sent in a great content piece about just hyperglycemia management, which sometimes isn't super sexy, but is something like, man, do we see all the darn time. So I wanted to hear from you first. How'd you guys get interested to deep dive this topic?
You know, we started noticing how commonly and routinely blood work is done, especially when wait times increase and people are sitting in the waiting room. So we're constantly getting routine labs. And I started noticing, like logically, how many of these patients had elevated blood sugar. And I would start going around asking the residents and some of the faculty, how do you treat these? And they'd say, you know, if they're not being in the hospital, admitting them, we'll give them IV fluids or we'll have them see their doctor. And that was pretty much it. And I thought that was just amazing. And I started looking at all the textbooks, a lot of the online EM resources to see, are there guidelines to how to manage elevated blood sugar in non-endocrine emergencies in patients that are discharged? And amazingly enough, nothing existed. And that's what got us interested.
So you guys sent in this great management algorithm. And by the way, I completely agree with you. Like, I'm also an academic center and I hear from the residents. They're like, well, Dr. So-and-so wants to do this and Dr. So-and-so does this. They're like, what do you like doing? So it's clearly, you know, a gestalt of what people's independent practices are. So you guys came up with a management algorithm, which we'll try to link a picture for. But help walk me through this.
Yeah. So I can kind of field this question here. So, to kind of create the algorithm itself, it took numerous iterations to kind of work through it all. But like breaking it down into what I would guess I would call the basics, we really kind of dove through the literature. There are innumerable resources out there when looking for how to manage, you know, blood sugars, essentially on a chronic basis at this point. And so really dove through all those resources and tried to compile what we felt was like the most simplified algorithm conducive to use in the emergency department. And of course, we used our resources as well. Dylan Allseth, he's one of our ED pharmacists that just does an incredible job helping us in the ER. And he was super helpful in helping to develop this algorithm as well.
So we took some very basic concepts. We said, first of all, what is considered to be an elevated blood sugar? And the thing is that we're really looking at is that this is not just for diabetics. This is anyone coming into the emergency department. And so we try to make this simple. Like Evan said, Dr. Springer said, most of the guidance out there is on the long-term management of diabetes. So if you look at the American Diabetes Association, if you look at the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, they're all looking at ongoing management. Our goal was not to do how do you manage these people long-term. It's what interventions can we do on the short term to get people into follow-up, but also try to enhance their outcome. So we first looked at said, if your blood sugar routinely is above, you know, a random blood sugar in the emergency department, if it's greater than 200 milligrams per deciliter, that automatically puts you into this realm that we need to look at how well they're managing their sugar. Knowing that information and then checking their A1C allows us to fit them into a very specific algorithm divided in half. One half of this algorithm is, wow, I never knew I had an elevated blood sugar. I'm not on any medication. What do I do? Versus the other half of the algorithm is, I have diabetes. I'm sort of compliant. I either take oral meds, insulin, or a combination of both, but I'm not getting good control. How can I manage it? And that's how we divided out this algorithm. And we tried to make sure that whatever recommendations were there were based on existing guidelines. Our costs are reasonable. So patients that have no insurance but still afford to do this, and it could be standardized across a wide population base.
So to get even into the algorithm, though, because obviously you want to know that this patient is not an endocrine emergency, you must at least get a BMP, right, to just rule out DKA?
If a person, you know, it's, you know how it is. You know, you're not going to see a DKA patient that just has a little bit of cellulitis on their leg and otherwise feels fine. I mean, that is a clinician perspective. So, you know, some of that is gestalt and some of that is, they look sick. They're tachycardic. They're vomiting. Come on. We've done this long enough. We know those patients. And look, routine labs are done all the time. So it's fine to do all of that. But in some patients, your typical, you know, I got a perirectal abscess. Okay, we're going to do a quick IND. They don't even look that sick. But realizing that knowing their blood sugar may help us to predict forward in terms of what their prognosis is.
Got it. So a mix of clinical gestalt and also labs to make sure that they're not an endocrine emergency, followed by, I know you guys also drop out special populations, which here I'm just referencing your image, which is no pregnant and no pediatric patients. I would love to focus on the not currently treated with glucose lowering medications, which to me usually means that we're the ones diagnosing the diabetes, which again, often means that they don't have primary care. So I love that your first step is checking a hemoglobin A1C. I would also love to hear, was that a challenge for you at your hospital? Like, did you guys have point of care versions? Was it a quick turnaround lab? Was it controversial in any way? I've worked at various systems where, you know, sometimes nurses are like, what are you doing? And, or sometimes the lab just, you know, batches them and then doesn't process them while the patient's in the ER.
Yeah, I can speak to this a little bit. You know, just as a resident working with all of the different attendings that we have the pleasure of working with, there is definitely some hesitancy in checking an HbA1c. And it's a little bit of that kind of old dogma that we're trying to challenge here, a little bit of, gosh, you know, I don't want to be on the hook for, you know, whatever we find on this lab test, right? If their hemoglobin A1c comes back and it's 8.7, I don't you know, want to be the one to have ordered that and have it be lost and follow up and all the things. And I think, again, a lot of that is old dogma. And as long as we're addressing, you know, in our documentation why we're checking the A1C and that we talk to the patient about what these results mean and the importance of ultimately long-term follow-up with specialty care or primary care or whoever it is, that I think it's a reasonable place to start. But there is a little bit of a challenge. I agree with the hesitancy to check those sorts of labs.
If you don't do the test, if you don't want to deal with the results. But what we really found was our lab had pretty impressively, we have a pretty impressive quick turnaround on the A1C. So it's not like we're going to add an hour or 2 hours to their clinical course. We get this back fairly quickly.
Wonderful. And I think this is, I think just highlighting the point that may be worth making is if this podcast changes your personal practice, it might be worth asking about the lab availability of a hemoglobin A1C, because I do see that as an unusual one for possibly every department. Like my ERs are like yours, like it's actually not a big deal if we order it, but it was a point I wanted to highlight. And then I wanted to also have you guys walk us through, after you have a hemoglobin A1C, what do you do with the result?
So if you divide the group into two groups, someone who's not taking any medication at all, knowing the A1C helps you fit into at least a treatment algorithm, because it's important to understand that just an infection, you can basically get a hyperglycemia defined as 200 or above simply from the infection itself. So that becomes a good starting point to realize that this person is at risk of bad outcome. If we combine that with an A1C, and an A1C is basically giving you a sense of what their blood sugar control has been for the past 3 months, with some influence of what the blood sugar has been running for the past 6 months. So if the hemoglobin is less than 7%, but it's a little bit high for the infection, in many cases, just simply, you know, stop drinking all the soda, cut down your carbs, exercise a little bit, may be sufficient. If we're above 7 to 8%, that's when metformin can begin medication. It's cheap, $4 or $5 a month, simple to use, low risk of hypoglycemia. All these patients should be started on metformin. Once you get above 8.5%, metformin is not going to be sufficient to reduce your glucose and have any impact on your A1C. And that's when you want to start considering adding another oral medication like, you know, Glyburide are also about $5 to $10 a month that you can add. But in our patient population, which is a very poor population, a lot of immigrants, a lot of high-risk population, when you're getting above 10, the oral medications are not going to be sufficient to address your elevated blood sugar or your chronic ongoing issue. And that's when considering starting them on a longer-acting insulin should be considered. And I'm saying that's pretty simple. And again, inexpensive, can be managed pretty easily. And in most cases, the risk here of hypoglycemia is on the lower side than automatically starting them on an insulin regimen right off the start, meaning, you know, just a short acting that increases the risk, more education. But that is a fairly straightforward approach, you know, and you realize that, sure, follow up with primary care. If you don't have insurance, the likelihood of getting follow-up is low, and the average wait time can be a month. So if you're treating a cellulitis or an abscess and you're not treating this hyperglycemia because you want to refer them to primary care, the reality of life is they may not obtain that follow-up, and they may, as a result, suffer from poor consequence.
That was the exact point I think you highlighted really well, is this is an algorithm that walks you through treatment initiation that a primary care doctor could do, but it's really simple, so we can do it in the ER because it bridges that gap that we all know exists for patients maybe not getting into their primary care. So this was super helpful. I would love to hear what you guys do for the patients that are already on glucose-lowering medications.
Yeah, so I think that this is a little bit trickier of a population in some ways. I think that one of the most important things that we can take from this is if they're already on glucose-lowering medications, whether that be metformin or a sulfonylurea or insulin therapy already, we want to maximize the effect of that therapy, right? So really talking to your patients, seeing what their patterns are with taking their medications. Are they truly compliant, or is this truly in kind of an unmet need? So I think that's the first part. You really have to sit down and talk to your patients and see what barriers they have to taking the medications that they're currently on. And then, you know, taking it from there, right? Titrating doses. We have some information, and I won't walk you through the entire algorithm, but number one question is, can the dose be titrated up or down? And if it can, maybe that's a good place to start. It's already on a medication that they know and that they presumably have been talked to about before. And then I think, you know, maybe a little bit more challenging of a piece is starting them on insulin, which I'm sure we'll get into a little bit later, the details of that. But yeah, so I think that's probably the overarching principle.
I like the principle of the oral medicines, like maximize the dose and then add the next agent. Like that I feel like is pretty simple. I do think insulin is where I see challenges. Patients already on insulin, let's say they're in compliant with it and, you know, they're still 400 and nothing acute is going on. That's where I really see ER doctors go, you know, hey, I'm not totally sure. And insulin's like a, you know, a medicine that comes with some risk. And, you know, then they say, go to your endocrinologist or go to your primary care. But you do have a little bit of you do have an algorithm here. I would actually love to hear you walk us through it.
So, you know, we use the managers all the time in the hospital. We adjust their short, their fast acting and their long acting. So many of us, we've been doing that. So making the adjustments is probably okay. There's no doubt. I have somebody with an infection, elevated blood sugar, no resources, and you can just sense these patients, they're not going to do well. In that circumstance, at least at our hospital, we have an option of where our hospitals will see them the next day to begin the diabetic education and begin the process. In some cases, we know this patient's at extremely high risk and we'll admit them just to get these things managed. But you know, all of us know, a lot of these patients are basically either poorly compliant with their medication or their diet. So this is a forced opportunity for us to get involved with the patients to talk about the importance of an elevated blood sugar may cause bad outcomes and how they need to be part of that process. But it's where you are at comfort level. Hopefully we could share, Dr. Springer put together a great list of resources. So we have QR codes that we could share in the show notes to give people great videos on how to manage their diet, how to use insulin, how to take their medication. So we try to create a comprehensive program that makes this easier for clinicians to implement.
And I think you make a really good point that this is a population that has a lot of, let's say, social determinants associated, right? That resulted in poor follow-up, sometimes poor compliance, sometimes difficulty with understanding the medication, sometimes not having resources to be able to, better adhere to their medicines. And what I really loved about some of the content you sent us was talking about some of these barriers and challenges, including cost, that you've mentioned in here. Could you talk me through that? You already talked a little bit about the cost of medications, which I think is really helpful. That's certainly a concern when we start a patient on a new medicine. But could you talk me through a couple more of those points?
In discussing, at least with our providers, at our hospital, one of the most common barriers that we found, and we touched on it a little bit, was about the resources. In our hospital has diabetic educators that do some work in the ER, but most of it is all inpatient work. And of course, we're not replacing what they do. They do incredible work, and it's really, really important that we have them available to use. But in the ER, things move quickly and we don't always have time. So compiling those resources, and I encourage anybody, taking a listen here to kind of flip through those resources that we have and familiarize yourself. As a resident, it was pretty eye-opening to me. I really had this gut feeling that everything was going to be extremely complicated and that there was no way I was going to be able to figure this out and that, not much that I could do, but really when you look through these resources, it is pretty simple. And it is something that I think that we should be empowered to do using some of those resources that we compiled. And again, we're not replacing the formal diabetes education. That is something that needs to happen. But in the short term, I think that we can do a good job addressing most of those barriers with some of the resources we have.
Yeah, the oral medications are inexpensive, $8 to $10 a month at most. And even the more expensive long-acting, the glargine, is only about $30 to $35 a month. So much less than it was a year ago. So much of this is, doable for our patients.
The cost of insulin, I love that call out, because that was one of my takeaways from reading your article was, insulin used to be really expensive, like $30 for insulin seems pretty achievable. I would love to hear what are each of your, three takeaways that you would like emergency physicians to have after listening to this conversation and after doing the deep dive and algorithm work that you guys put into this topic.
Well, if I could lead, I'd say number one, we need to understand hyperglycemia is an independent risk factor for poor outcomes, regardless if you have diabetes or not. And that's an important point to understand, because many of our patients may not have a diagnosis of diabetes, but now they're coming with a blood sugar 250 and they have a perirectal abscess. That hyperglycemia is an independent risk factor. And I think that physicians should consider ordering blood sugar on patients with concerning infections, cellulitis, abscess, pneumonia, even UTIs. The advantage of a urinalysis is you can actually see if they're spilling glucose in their urine. That's a pretty routine test there. And if it's positive, it gives you an opportunity to check their blood sugar. And I think, we can manage this stuff. I mean, it's amazing. We can manage every emergency, but oh goodness, hyperglycemia, ooh, that's kind of outside my black bag of medicines. I have to refer them to somewhere else. We have the ability to manage this, and we need to understand that they may not get follow-up, and they may not get good care even if they're followed up. We're not even knowing that the primary care that sees them will recognize hyperglycemia in a non-diabetic as being important or not. We can do all of this.
Yeah, I don't think that I could have said that any better myself. I think that the idea is complex, but it is not too complex. We this is absolutely something that we should empower ourselves to manage in the ER. And then I think just adding on, knowing your resources in your shop, whether that is you have, you know, a staffed ED pharmacist who would be, at least in our experience with Dylan working alongside us, more than happy to come and help us kind of in this endeavor, whether you have diabetic educators or just are simply using the resource that we've provided. Make sure you know what you have available to you to help make this easier approach.
Great. And I want to applaud you guys again for deep diving a topic that we see all the time. I'm a little surprised there wasn't more evidence on it as well, because I took a look when I saw your content too. And again, thank you guys for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Emmett and Howard have a great discussion. Please, please, please check out the image with their algorithm in the show notes, as well as the resources that Evan talks about for patient teaching. I love their chat here because it's such a great example of protocolizing something to be simple and salient and achievable, so we can fill in where the health system has sometimes failed. Because like Dr. Levitin and Dr. Springer, many, many, many of us also work with patient populations who don't have a PCP and who don't have a hope for timely follow-up, and all they have is us. So with that, there is lots more in the magazine this month. There is, of course, a review on the MATCH results last month. There's a great topic piece as well on AI scribing, because if it's not in your ER yet, my prediction is that it will be within the next 5 years. So start paying attention now. There's a couple great clinical topics, of course. There's one on diagnosing a posterior stroke so that you don't miss it. And a great case report that, while on the topic of sugar, it is about toxic hypoglycemic syndrome, and of course, much, much more. As always, tweet us if you have an idea at ASAPNow, or feel free to tweet me direct at Amy Faith Ho. We would love to hear your thoughts and feedback and keep you tuning in. So thanks, everyone. We will see you all next time.